Hello and welcome to this quarantine edition of Sacktown Talks. Today, we got an exciting show today. We have the president of the Rental Housing Association with us, Sid Lacaretti, to talk all things housing in California. Sid, how you doing? Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Hey, our pleasure. Hoping to dig into some of the hot housing topics of today. Obviously, a lot's going on in your sector last few years. You know, there's been ballot initiatives, legislative deals, and of course, during the pandemic here, a lot's been changed here in the rental housing market. I just wanted to see if you could quickly tell us about the Rental Housing Association and your role there.
Sure. I'm the president of the California Rental Housing Association. We're a rental housing association that represents mom and pop property owners up and down the state of California. We represent a little bit more than 22,000 members who own and manage a little bit more than 500,000 rental units in the state of California.
A lot's going on, at least, you know, executive orders. You know, a lot of people aren't working right now. Kind of what's the status right now with your members and kind of, you know, people paying rent?
April was not as bad as everybody was thinking it was going to be, but I think there's still a lot of fear of what lays in the future and how long this lasts and how long people are going to be out of work. What we have seen is a lot of property owners step up and do the right thing. But the question is, how much more can we absorb before we as an industry are, you know, brought to our knees, so to speak?
I know a lot's been done at the federal level in terms of stimulus packages with the Paycheck Protection Program. Have your members been able to access any of that stimulus from the federal government to help offset their mortgage payments?
Unfortunately, no. And the issue there is that most property owners in the state are mom and pop, which means they don't have a payroll. They take care of their properties themselves. And we represent approximately 3/4 of the rental housing stock in California, not the big shiny apartment complexes with, you know, nice leasing offices. That isn't the majority of the rental stock. The majority of the rental stock is mom and pop owned. And that means they go out there and try to make their fixes themselves or call, you know, John down the street to go make that fix. And they don't carry a payroll. What they do is they hire outside vendors. And that's what our business primarily relies upon. And that's what we support is outside vendors, independent contractors and whatnot, who can go make these small repairs every day.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. I actually live in a rental by a small mom and pop, kind of how you describe that. And actually, you know, we were just pondering moving because, you know, the school year is kind of in flux now, but, you know, my kids are going to be starting to go to a new school. So we're looking at moving to a new area. And kind of ran into the problem that, you know, depending on when this is lifted, you know, we're not going to be able to move. And so kind of how are you seeing inventory right now with people in vacancies and kind of trying to fill those vacancies? Are you having any difficulties?
Well, yes, I think the entire industry is having difficulties surrounding this right now. You know, one thing is for sure, there's been, you know, we were in the middle of a housing crisis and it was getting to a boiling point and the pressure release valve has been open now. And I think a lot of that pressure in the housing market is going to be released. I mean, it's not going to be a long-term solution to our problem. You know, it was 30 years of mistakes that got us here and it's going to take a long time to address it. But in the short term, I think there's a lot of pressure that's been released out of the housing market. We are already seeing rents go down quite a bit in some markets. No property owner wants to be sitting with a vacancy right now. I think the tenant has all the negotiating leverage right now. And property owners, if they still want to make their ends meet, are going to have to be very reactive.
Okay, that's interesting. So you're seeing, I guess, more rentals becoming available. There's more supply. I guess you're saying the supply's met the demand within the last
couple months. Yes, because typically what happens in any recession, and this is a recession unlike any others at this point, because just with the speed and the onset of it so quickly, is you start to see people who may have been paying more for convenience by living close to their work say, I don't need that right now. I'm willing to commute a little bit further if they're lucky enough to still have their job. Those people, there are other people who will say, you know what? I don't mind having a roommate, whereas previously they had the luxury of saying, I don't want a roommate. So you'll see occupancy sizes go up of units, and you'll start seeing people who are going to be way more price sensitive. I think when you get to the top of any market like we were before this happened, you see a lot more people spending their disposable income on convenience, which now takes a back seat.
Okay, interesting. You know, a lot of industry groups have been approaching the governor's office looking for some sort of relief with executive order or possibly looking for relief via the budget. Are you guys working on anything to help these mom and pop landlords get some relief here?
Yes, we've been pushing very hard for a rental assistance program where the renter would be eligible to have their rent paid for if they need the help. And this is a very important program, not just for our industry, but for the economy of California. Let's face it, we're a nation state. We have, you know, $100, $200 billion, I don't know, overall spending and budget. We are a $500 billion industry in the state of California. Now, that money doesn't go straight into the property owner's pocket. A very, very small percentage of that does. The rest of the money is paid out to whether it's paid in taxes to support local schools, support local frontline workers, first responders, whether it's, you know, the cascading effect of paying all those vendors who help keep our property sanitary, safe, and allow us to provide a safe home for residents to shelter in place. And that has a massive cascading effect if we are no longer allowed to pay our bills, or able to pay our bills, I should say. So that highlights the importance of why a renter's assistance program is necessary immediately, especially if there's talk of, you know, we don't know how we're going to come out of this. We don't know if we're going to have to go back into this. So something needs to be stood up and brought out for the sake of the entire state, not just for our industry.
That's an interesting point, because I remember when this first started happening, everyone was screaming, hey, we need, you know, rent forgiveness for all these renters out there. And I guess, you know, as you've pointed out, there's two sides of this coin. You know, there's people who own these rentals who are having to make mortgage payments and expense payments. And if they're not getting their rent, you know, they're not necessarily going to be able to, you know, pay their mortgage. And then that, you know, then what do the banks do if they're not getting their mortgage payments? You know, are we going to have a rush of foreclosures? So that, you know, that chain reaction, you know, we definitely need to be, you know, keeping that in mind when we're looking at relief for these specific groups. And I think, you know, what you pointed out is a very good point is, you know, if we just can cover their rent, that's an easy way of, you know, covering the whole supply chain that you just described.
And beyond that, I think something that really propelled that movement about cancel rent early on when this crisis hit was that the federal government came out and said, hey, you know, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, government agencies, they are going to forbear if requested on your mortgage. And, you know, the governor announced there's 30 banks who've all signed on and agreed to forbear on mortgages. But what wasn't written in the press was that this is for single family homeowners. This does not apply to multifamily people who rent out apartments. And very few loans that are subsidized by the government, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, which was the first to come out and say this, actually have loans on properties in California. So the vast majority of the rental housing stock in California is not covered by these forbearance agreements. This is for the single family property owner, the, you know, the people who own their home and are having trouble making their mortgage payment in their home and maybe need to spend that money on their food instead of their mortgage now. Right. But that doesn't cover people who are renting out the homes to people. And so there is that huge misconception out there that really has to be clarified.
Oh, interesting. Just to kind of switch topics a bit, you know, last, what's that, 2018, there was a big rent control initiative brought forth, and it looks like that's coming back again for 2020. You know, there's been some legislative fixes in the legislature last year on this topic. Kind of how are you guys seeing this conversation on rent control going, and what do you see happening here in 2020 on that issue?
Well, you know, 2019 was also a big year. And that was the age of AB 1482, which was legislation that was negotiated and, you know, argued on both sides. And we eventually landed somewhere, and it created a new landscape for rental housing in the state of California, because, you know, it's characterized as anti-gouging. Others characterize it as rent control. But whatever it is, it can't be argued that it is a price control. And that was legislation that everybody had to live with. We accepted it as the new paradigm, and that's how we were going to go forward. Now, in light of COVID, there's a lot of efforts, whether it's in Sacramento and on a more local level, to undo this bill that was arrived at. And I don't think you should use the backdrop of a crisis to undo something that was agreed to during rational days. In other words, let's not make irrational knee-jerk movements to erase something that took a long time to arrive at. And the real fear is that that's what's happening, and that's what's going to be done if some of these legislative bills move through Sacramento that are being talked about. And that's not going to help anybody in the long term. In the long term, we still need to figure out how to solve our housing crisis. These sort of reactions are not going to help that.
Right. Kind of what are some of the solutions you see to solving the state's housing crisis?
So now we're switching gears into a whole other topic. I mean, we're talking a macro topic apart from COVID, just so the listeners can understand. But, you know, there's no solution other than to build our way out of it. But I think there's also another dynamic to this, which hasn't been talked about, that I'm really starting to ramp up, which is we need to talk about reducing the cost to deliver housing. No matter how much we build, if it's costing as much as it's costing today to deliver housing, we're going to have a very hard time to deliver housing for the middle. I mean, sure, there is these, you know, trickle down effects, if you want to use that term. I know it's not a great term to use, but, you know, there's plenty of studies that say, look, if somebody builds a new unit within 5 years, three other families will move into a better unit than they were previously occupying before that high-end unit was built. And that takes time. But if we really want to start delivering housing in mass for the middle class, we have to talk about how to reduce the cost to deliver housing. And there's a lot of things there that can be discussed. And I think when we pass a lot of good intention laws, especially there in Sacramento, there is no cost-benefit analysis being done with vis-a-vis housing. And that really needs to be looked at.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, I was just looking at some local governments who are trying to build low-income, low-cost housing. And, you know, they were saying it was about $500,000 a unit here in Sacramento. And that just seems outrageous to me. What kind of price per unit are you looking for low-income housing where you're looking at, Sid?
So I can tell you in the city of Berkeley, with free land, they're paying north of $900,000 to deliver one studio apartment. You could go out and buy a brand new built building where the land wasn't even free for less than $500,000 of that same size. So you could see there's a big discrepancy when people are calling for the government to deliver housing, because they're the primary catalyst right now for delivering the lowest end housing for the lowest income bracket people, the residents. And there's a big problem there. How are you going to build the 300,000 units or 3 million units we need if it's going to cost $1 million a unit? That's fiscally impossible, especially now that we're going to be going into a period of declining tax revenues. So this is an important part to look at, because what I've realized in doing some research is that most other states don't have the onerous building requirements that California does and continues to push forward. And that is actually hampering the production of housing at a more affordable cost.
So it's just not the cost of materials, you're saying, it's the additional kind of regulatory burdens we've placed on building units that's really driving these prices up.
I'll give you two examples. I mean, the fundamental question is, let's say if a housing was built in 2015, right? And you built that same housing today to the same design, that unit would probably cost $75,000 to $100,000 less than what we have to build today in 2020 because of all the regulatory changes in building codes, whether it's the mechanical building code, whether it's the plumbing building code. And the question is, what benefit are we getting by updating these codes every 3 years? And does that benefit outweigh the cost? And that's a discussion that, as far as I know, is not being had, and that needs to be sparked up and down the state.
And are you seeing different regulatory burdens in different local jurisdictions? Is there any uniformity statewide on this issue?
There is a uniform building code, and it is pretty uniform up and down the state. So how it's enforced and, you know, how liberal, they localities do have some leeway in some of this. But usually the easiest thing for any local jurisdiction to do is adopt whatever the state says they've adopted and move on.
Right.
But that can no longer be the way of the future because, like I said, it's raising the cost too quickly. And, you know, a perfect example is you talk to a carpenter. Carpenter will say, well, we build a building completely different today than we did 5-6 years ago. And, you know, is it worth it?
Yeah.
Is
it worth it? Does it need to be built different than it did 5 years ago?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. There's not a lot of buildings falling down. So yeah, that's a good point. I was wondering if you could go into, you know, back to the whole rent control talk. You know, do you know the differences in what, you know, the Weinstein Initiative is proposing and what the legislation passed last year? You know, can you go into detail on those issues?
So the Weinstein Initiative, as it stands right now, would limit how much a apartment could be rented for after it becomes vacant. So you're a mom and pop property owner, you have your 5-unit building or 4-unit building, one of the units become vacant. Typically, over most of the country, everywhere else, you could determine what you want to rent it for, and you try to rent it at the market price. You might even lower the rent to get a better tenant. You might raise the rent because you've upgraded everything in the unit. The Weinstein Initiative would now say, you, the property owner, don't have that right to say what that rent is. We will tell you what that rent is when it is completely vacant and when you put it back on the market. And that is the fundamental gist of the Weinstein Initiative. They want to tell you what you should be able to rent that unit at.
So basically rents would be locked in for a long period of time and you guys wouldn't be able to keep up with market.
That's exactly right. And meanwhile, you know, everything else keeps up with market. And if you are serious about wanting to build 3 million units in California and solving the housing crisis, I ask you, what lender, what investor are, you know, would want to invest in a political climate like that when they have 49 other states to pick from? Yeah. You know, that would be the worst climate. And you need money to build this housing, and it has to come from places, and it's not going to come, you know, from local people on the streets here. No, you know, to fund the projects at what it costs to deliver housing today, you're going to have to bring money in from all over the world. And that's typically what's funded development in California for the last 20 years, 30 years or more.
Yeah, you know, you gave that example of that $900,000 studio there in Berkeley. And, you know, I was just quickly trying to figure out the return on investment for that one bedroom studio. And you'd have to be able to charge a pretty high rent for that to make any sense to, you know, an investor to take that risk on. So, you know, that's just a great example of, you know, a small project that is just being burden based, you know, when you start looking at scale at some of these larger projects you're talking about. Yeah, it would be really tough for anyone to throw money at something where, you know, they might not be getting a return or getting a very small return, especially if, you know, we're looking at some serious inflation coming down the road with all this stimulus. So.
And you can't discount the changing political landscape on a daily basis. This fight was had in 2018. Typically, you don't have these fights again every 2 years. And, or, you know, this discussion, the discourse, whatever you want to call it. And if it keeps coming up, you're just going to be making nervous investors more nervous. And we're not helping ourselves by you know, rehashing what's already been decided.
Yeah. Another initiative that's kind of qualified for the ballot so far is the split role initiative. Is that something that your association is, taking action on, or is that separate from what you guys
are? We are watching that closely for a couple of different reasons. One, and I think the primary one amongst all our members, is the feeling that if that initiative wins, then our industry will be the next one that they will go after. Because let's be honest, no state, no government, no municipality will ever say, I have enough money, I don't need more money. That you know,
hasn't happened yet. No,
I mean, it will never happen, and it's unreasonable. So yeah, they're going to say, we can raise $21 billion with this initiative, but, and in 3 years, we all know they're going to say, but that's not enough, because we need more, and there's never going to be enough. So primarily with that thought, we, our members, are very apprehensive about this initiative moving forward and passing. So for that reason, we are against it. And the second part to that is restaurants are already hurting. The service industry is approximately 32% of our economy. The service industry operates out of commercial buildings, which this proposition goes straight after. Now, do you really want to burden that industry even more with this going into the recession we're going into? That's just plain economic suicide on the part of California at this point. You know, what I said before applied pre-COVID, but post-COVID, now it could just be characterized, in my opinion, as economic suicide for the state of California by killing off a third of the businesses here.
Right. So kind of talking about the real estate market in general, you know, when this first started, I don't think anyone knew how long this was going to be. And now that we're still, 40 days into this, I still don't think we know how long this is going to be until we get back to quote unquote normal, if we ever get there. What are your thoughts on how this is going to have overall effects in the real estate market, kind of where you see the real estate market heading in the next 2 years?
It's headed down, without a doubt. It's headed down. There's going to be a lot of foreclosures in a few months. That, you know, it's going to be 2008, 9, 10 all over again. And there's no disputing that at this point. Anybody who entered and bought a piece of real estate in the last 2 years, you know, is going to be really hurting. And you're going to see those, you know, banks taking them back, foreclosures happening. And there's also systemic problems higher up, you know, in the whole industry beyond us, which is, you know, you're talking about mortgage service lenders or servicers not being able to make payments as, you know, Main Street isn't able to make their payments. And if that industry goes under, then banks are going to have a much bigger problem. And, you know, there's going to be tons of litigation. So without a doubt, the real estate market is headed down. Rents are headed down. Vacancies are going to go up. And that's just what happens when you're in the middle of a recession. And when you come out, you try to hold on through the recession and try to come out on the other side.
Right. Yeah, I remember in 2008, I just had graduated law school and coming out and just seeing, you know, how the house here in Sacramento, for sure, was, you know, drastic, you know, how housing falling, you know, 3/4 of value in a couple of months. What about in the Bay Area? You know, it's kind of thought that, you know, that the dip won't be as bad there or as existent as in 08. Do you think that will hold true this time as well?
Well, I think there's another component to that, which is, yeah, there will be a dip here in the Bay Area. And in my thinking, at least, that dip could even be further down, larger. It could be a larger dip than in 2008, 9, than the Great Recession, because I think a lot of people are going to also be rethinking, do we need to have all these workers working in an office building? Or what percentage of our workers, our employees, can work from home or work remotely? And if that, you know, if people start changing those habits, even when the Bay Area returns back to job growth, which drives growth and helps us pull out of the recession, it may not have the same impact on these urban areas as it did last time. Because maybe now people will just start saying, I don't need to be in the office at all anymore. So maybe finally the growth will finally occur first in those tertiary markets, apart from these primary markets.
And that's interesting you bring that up. I know like Salesforce and a lot of these other tech companies have really promoted the kind of work from home environment. Do you see that then kind of people spreading out more and moving more to the valley, kind of like was the trend pre-2008?
Yeah, and I think that might start to happen again when this whole work from home thing and this realization that maybe we don't need 90% of our office staff in the office every day. Maybe we can make do with 30% or 40%. But the contra to that is the fundamental notion, I think, within tech, and I'm, wading into waters that I probably shouldn't, but, that you want to have synergy and collaboration for new ideas and new thoughts to happen. And how much does that occur when you're working remotely is going to be the new question, I think, that's going to have to answer.
Yeah, it's the big question. Kind of touching back on the COVID thing, I know a lot of industries are kind of thinking about, what additional things they need to do in light of this virus in terms of cleaning and kind of physical separation, things like that. Are there any, I guess, specific things that you foresee rental housing owners are going to have to do to kind of clean their units and additional costs and precautions they're going to have to take?
Oh, definitely. I mean, there's the operation sides of things are going to have to fundamentally change to a large degree until we get a vaccine or, it's eradicated. Operations being maintenance. Can you do maintenance and go into somebody's unit to fix whatever needs to be fixed while that person is there? Or do you now have to arrange a time when that person is out of the house and the maintenance person can now enter the house? That's one example. Another example that's more immediate is, when people move out, how do you disinfect that unit? Normally we have everything clean, the resident is responsible for cleaning as well, but now can you even trust what that resident has done is enough? And what extra precautions are, these property owners going to take to help give some peace of mind to that incoming resident that everything is safe and okay. And finally, I would say on the operation side, one of the things we deal with as property owners a lot is garbage. We deal with a lot of trash all the time. So it's not just the residents.
Right.
And now, we're going to have to take way more precautions with regards to dealing with that issue as well. And, it's a public health issue. And many times you also see a lot of furniture recycled as opposed to going straight into the dump, which is great. But now, do you really want that many touch points for that furniture that, used to trade hands?
Right.
Now, that's going to be increased wastage also. So, there's going to have to be some fundamental rethinking about how things are done in our industry.
And I guess if people are going to be spending more time at home, I guess that's going to increase the wear and tear on a lot of the things in the unit that you might have to replace sooner rather than later.
Yeah. And, it's also going to increase the utility bills, more water usage, more, electricity usage and everything else. So property owners are probably going to see a spike definitely in their utility bills as well that they have to cover.
Yeah. Well,
and garbage, increased garbage too.
the whole gamut. Well, Sid, thank you so much for joining us. Is there anything else you want to plug or get out there?
I just want to go back and reiterate that it is imperative that the state of California get a renter's assistance program going as soon as possible. These other ideas floating out there of eviction moratoriums, this and that, that, you know, that's not going to solve a problem. Property owners aren't running out there to evict tenants. What we should be promoting is property owners and residents working together to solve each other's mutual problems. And just saying, oh, evictions, you know, we'll close that off and that'll solve the problem. That's not going to solve anything. We as property owners want to keep our residents. We like our residents. Our residents like us. But there's 800,000 of us property owners throughout the state of California. There's always going to be a bad apple. Yes, there's always going to be a jerk who hasn't done the right thing. But don't let that paint the picture for the entire state and for of every property owner. No, there's been plenty of us who've stepped up to do the right thing. I know personally I've had many tenants who've, you know, been affected like a lot of people have, and I've abated their rent. I know there was a property owner in San Diego who in April, you know, said there's a 10% across the board rent cut for everybody in the that they house. And if you want to give that money back to a pot of money that we will administer, you can give that back so we could help. We could redirect that money to where it could be more useful in the fight against COVID. And they raised $100,000 that way. And then they, as a company, matched it dollar for dollar, came up with $200,000. And then the Sacramento Utility Company matched that dollar for dollar, and they're able to give away $400,000 to the United Way. Similarly, there's a lot of other property owners doing things like that. I know, at least in my small world, at least a handful of people who've initiated programs like that. And I know many more property owners who've initiated like a 20% across the board rent cut while the state of emergency is in place, voluntary, before anybody even came and asked. So these are all stories that are out there that we also have to remember. And what I think we need to, what we need to get out of the consciousness of policy making is that it is an adversarial relationship. It is not an adversarial relationship. Property owners think of residents as their customers, and as any good business should, you want to treat your customer right. Otherwise, you know, you're not going to be in business. So let's stop thinking of it in that dynamic, and we need to shift the focus.
Yeah. As a renter myself, I do love my landlord. He always fixes anything and any issue. And being a homeowner and having to deal with the issues versus being a renter and having a landlord deal with the issues is a much better prospect.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Many years ago, we did a public opinion survey of renters. And what we found was, you know, I think like 50% of renters had a negative opinion of property owners. And then when you asked what their specific relationship with their property owner was, 75% said good to great. So, you know, that is what we're combating. That's what we're trying to get out there, that we don't have this adversarial relationship.
Right.
You know, and unfortunately, some evictions are going to happen and are going to be necessary no matter when, no matter what. And we have to start talking about what is an acceptable eviction rate. That rate can't be zero, because you can't say, you know, there's 20 million renters in the state of California and all 20 million are doing the right thing and only property owners are wrong. No.
Right.
Statistics say there is some percentage of that cohort that needs to be evicted, unfortunately. And, you know, so the dialogue also has to realize that.
Exactly, because you don't want bad renters in the homes. You know, it could turn an entire neighborhood. And that's, you know, an issue kind of going back to the recession of 08, we saw where a lot of people were taking over properties and renting them out to other people. And it kind of created this kind of weird situation where it was really hard to get rid of people.
Well, I know I had a property where when I walked into it, when the resident vacated, all the copper wire was pulled out of the walls.
Yeah.
And you say, what do I do with this? Or another property where, you know, the air conditioning unit went missing when they moved out. So these things do happen.
No, exactly. Well, thank you so much, Sid, for joining us, and look forward to talk to you again. Have a good afternoon.
You too.
All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of Sactown Talks. Please follow, like, and subscribe us on YouTube, and share and subscribe on Simplecast or where you listen on your podcast. Thank you. Así como tú pensás.